This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Isaac Hayes, the singer, songwriter, composer, and producer whose soul sound changed the world of music, died yesterday at his home in East Memphis, Tennessee. He was 65. Hayes is perhaps best known for his bass baritone voice and the theme to Shaft, which won an Academy Award in 1972. Born in rural Tennessee in 1942, Hayes began playing with local bands and became a songwriter, producer, and arranger for Stax Records, the legendary Memphis R&B label. He recorded several hits there, including the album Hot Buttered Soul and the Grammy-winning Black Moses, which influenced later generations of disco and hip-hop artists. Hayes also developed a trademark look with his shaved head, gold chains, and bare chest. In the 80s and 90s, Hayes found an acting career with roles in The Rockford Files and the films Escape from New York, The Duke, and the loving parody of blaxploitation films I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker. And he gave his voice to the character Chef on the animated series South Park until 2006. He continued performing in recent years despite health problems. Terry spoke to Isaac Hayes in 1994.
Now, I know before you started making your own records, before you started singing in your records, you produced for other people, and also you played piano and keyboards. Mm-hmm. You used to play with Booker T and the MGs. Now, how did you learn to play piano? Growing up as poor as you did, I know there were times in your life when you didn't have shoes, let alone a piano.
That's true. How did I do that? Well, let's see. A friend of mine I grew up with, Sidney Kirk, used to be my accompanist. We went places and he'd play for me. He joined the Air Force. He wasn't there. There was a call into him about a gig New Year's Eve. His sister knew that I was destitute and I needed money, so she asked me if I wanted to play. Well, I could play maybe chopsticks and stuff like that. And I said, yeah, I'll take it. I took the gig out of desperation. And when I got to the club, I was petrified. I said, oh, my God, they're going to shoot me. I can't play. And musicians started coming in, you know, setting up, tuning up, and I'm sitting there, you know, trying to be cool. I said, God, they're going to find me out. And the featured artist came in and said, hey, man, do y'all know such and such? This is the first time this band had been put together. We didn't rehearse anything. And everybody said, yeah, we know it, blah, blah, blah. So he kicked off the tune, and it sounded horrible. Everybody did. I said, wow, these guys can't play either, so I'm comfortable. And, you know, being New Year's Eve, the clientele was drunk, and they thought we were cooking, you know. So, and somewhere along the line, the club owner, he was sauced. He came up and said, you know, you boys sound real good. Y'all want a regular job? Yeah, we'll take it. And that was in Memphis, and it was a regular gig, and each night I would learn something more and more on the keyboards. And that's how I got started.
That's great. And then you started sitting in with Booker T and the MGs.
Well, I wound up at Stax Records. I changed bands, and I joined Floyd Newman's band, who was a staff musician at Stax. He played baritone saxophone. All those bot-ups and stuff like that, that was Floyd. So he was up for recording. He said, man, you know, we're going in the studio. And I had been... Prior, I had been to Stax about three different times with the blues band, with a vocal group, you know, trying to get a break, and it was always turned down.
Mm-hmm.
This time, went with Floyd and Howard Grimes, the drummer. He and I wrote some songs, some instrumentals, and things like that. And Jim Stewart, who, you know, was co-owner of Stax, he said, you know, you sound pretty good on keyboards. Booker T is off in Indiana U in school. Would you like to become a staff musician here? Yeah, you know. So that's how I got in Stax. And my first session, I think, was an Otis Redding album session. I was scared to death. But he made it easy. And I learned a lot, and I fit right in. And I became a staff musician. So when Booker came back, he and I both played on sessions. We would switch around. Sometimes I'd play organ, and he'd play piano. And sometimes I'd play piano, he'd play organ. And with Duck, Steve, and Al... we were the nucleus of Stax, the rhythm section, and then, of course, the horns and so forth.
Now, you were not only a house musician at Stax, you became a house songwriter, and you wrote a lot of songs with your partner then, David Porter. And some of the most famous songs that you wrote were for Sam and Dave, like Soul Man and Hold On, I'm Coming. What do you remember about writing Soul Man?
Well, I remember getting the idea from watching TV and the riots in Detroit. And it was said that if you put soul on your door, your business establishment, they would bypass it and wouldn't burn it. And then the word soul, you know, the clenched fist, you know, soul brother, soul this. It was a galvanizing kind of thing as far as, you know, African Americans were concerned. And it had that kind of effect of unity. And they said it with a lot of pride. So I said, well, why not write a tune called Soul Man? And all you had to do was write about your own personal experiences because, you know, all African Americans in this country, during those times especially, had similar experiences. So we did that, but realized that it, in addition to being an African American experience, it was a human experience. So therefore, it crossed the board. And then the groove and all everything else that went with it just made it, you know, very, very commercial.
So did you arrange this too?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And are you featured instrumentally?
I wasn't featured. I just played piano on it. Well, you know, I did some little hot licks in there and stuff like that. So,
okay. Well, let's hear Soul Man, co-written by my guest, Isaac Hayes. It took several years for you to actually record your own vocals.
Well, I started singing in high school. I sang before ninth grade. Pre-teen, I used to sing, but I sounded like somebody in the Vienna Boys Choir. My voice was way up there like that. And they would call me, oh, man, you're a sissy. So when I reached puberty, my voice started cracking and squeaking. And then when it cleared up, it was down in the basement. So I started singing again, and I was singing jazz. During my teenage years, I was singing jazz in a local nightclub. I was singing with a blues band. I was singing with a rock and roll group called the Teen Tones. I was singing with a gospel group called the Morning Stars. We had a little combo, and during my senior year, we played. So I had all this experience, and I would go to Jim Stewart, and say, hey, Jim, I want to record. I want to try something. Well, like, you know, we are R&B label. Your voice is too good. It's too good for what we're doing here. So I never did get the shot until one day it was someone's birthday party at Stax. And we always served champagne and cake. And we had gobbled down some cake. And Doug Dunn and I grabbed a couple of bottles of champagne and ran into the ladies' restroom and closed the door. And we just guzzled this champagne down. I mean, I got a buzz. Came out, Al Bell, who at that time was the head of national promotion. He wound up being executive vice president. But he said, Ike, I want to cut something on you. Okay, yeah, I don't care. I was feeling no pain. So we go in the studio, Al Jackson on drums, Duck on bass, and myself at piano. And I said, man, y'all follow me. It was all impromptu. And we stayed in the studio a few hours. And we finished it. I said, okay, I got what I want. And that was that wound up being presenting Isaac Hayes, my very first album.
You developed a style of singing in which you did long raps that kind of gave a backstory to the song. And the rap would lead you into the song. And the songs are often, you know, like pop tunes other people had written, like By the Time I Get to Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd kind of make up the whole story leading up to it. How did you start doing that, combining these raps with pop tunes?
Remember the famous quote in Cool Hand Luke? I forget the actor's name. What we have here is a failure to communicate.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Sure.
Well, I did that. The rap came out of the necessity to communicate. And the way it happened was is a local club in Memphis, predominantly black, that was called a Tiki Club. And, you know, we would hang out there. The Barcades were playing there sometimes. We'd hang out there and sit in, you know how musicians do. And this one day I heard this song by Glen Campbell, By the Time I Get to Phoenix. I said, wow, oh, that song is great. I mean, this man must really have loved this woman. And so I ran down the studio later on that day and said, man, y'all hear this song, Phoenix? Man, it's great. Everybody, yeah, yeah, you know, no enthusiasm. I'm saying, these guys don't feel what I feel. What, are they getting it? So the Barcades were scheduled to play at the Tiki Club a couple of days later, and I said, hey, man, I'm coming down and sit in with you guys. Learn By the Time I Get to Phoenix. They said, okay. I told him the key, and he flat. And so I went down, and the club was packed. Go up on stage. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, y'all know him, blah, 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 Isaac Hayes. And I mean, there's all kind of conversations going, you know, blah, 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 blah. I said, oh, man, how am I going to get these people's attention? So I said, hey, man, the first chord in the song, y'all hang up on it. It's a B-flat 11. Just hang up on the chord. Just keep cycling it. And I started talking. And I just started telling this story. How it was a scenario how about what could have happened to cause this man to leave, you know. And I started talking, and the conversations, halfway through the rap, that conversation started to subside. And when I reached the first line in the song, when I said, by the time I get to Phoenix, everybody went, wow. And, you know, when I finished the song, it wasn't a dry in the house.
Well, I want to play an excerpt of your recording of By the Time I Get to Phoenix. This is Isaac Hayes.
But one day, old boy got sick, and he had to come home. I don't have to tell you what he found. Oh, it hurt him so bad. He said, baby, mama, why? That's all he could say. But she said, oh, gone, fool, you doing it. But the man wasn't doing it, but that's the only excuse she could give him. He said, mama, I can't take it. I got to leave you. I'm going to leave you. Well, she tried to straighten up. She said she was going to straighten up. She got a little job to help him out with the bills, too. But that was just a sham. Because he found it again and again. And seven times he left this woman. And seven times he came back. And he had taken all that he could stand. And the eighth time that this went down, he said, mama, I got to go. He said, I'm leaving my heart right here. By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising. Oh, and she'll find a note I left hanging on the door. She'll laugh when she reads the part that says I'm leaving, and she will. Why? 'Cause I've left that girl so many times before. Oh, by the time
today we're remembering Isaac Hayes, who died yesterday, by listening to his 1994 interview on Fresh Air.
Now, you recorded the theme for the movie Shaft in, I guess it was 1971. How were you asked to do this?
Well, it was a whole concept. Hollywood recognized that they had to look further than they had been looking to get business. I think it was fledgling at the time. It was a bit stagnant. And Melvin Van Peebles had put out a a movie called Sweetback's Badass Song. And they said, it might be a market there. If we come up with a concept to have a black leading man, a black director, maybe a black composer, we might hit that market. MGM was the one that pioneered the idea. So we had a meeting out there at MGM with Stax execs, and they asked me to come. And they talked about the concept. And would I do the music? Would I be interested in doing the music? Yeah. I said, I want to act too, man. Have y'all cast for the lead role? Well, I don't know. We'll look into that. But anyway, I think that was a sticking carrot, you know. So, right. So I agreed to do the music. They had already cast Richard Roundtree, which was rightfully so. He's perfect for the part. And I agreed to do the music. And that's how that whole thing, that whole idea came about.
Here's where you really get into orchestrating, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how you started using that wah-wah guitar funk style.
Ha-ha. Well, okay, trade secrets. What happened was, I had been doing arranging all the time. I did a lot of arranging with the horns and stuff at Stax, and the first string arrangements I tried was a thing that Dave and I did on Sam and Dave. And that album was like a big flop. But we tried it anyway, but I had a taste for it. And once I tasted the strings, I couldn't let it go. Now, when sometimes in the studio you're working on various grooves and stuff and you can't find a name for it or you can't tag it with anything, you just, if it feels good, you say, okay, I'm going to file that. And you put it up. You put it back and you store it. Now, when it was time for me to do the Shaft theme, I said, now, what can I do? They explained the character to me, you know, a relentless character, always on the move, always on the prowl, and you got to get something to denote that for the main theme. I said, now, what can I do? I thought about, if you remember Otis Redding's Trial of Tenderness, I had a hand in that arrangement, too. In the end, Al Jackson was doing some stuff on a hi-hat cymbal, you know, you got to na-na-na, boom, you know. So I thought about that. I said, maybe if I just sustain that particular thing on the hi-hat, that would give you a dramatic effect as something that's relentless. Now, what else can I do? I thought about the guitar lick, and I went and pulled it out, played it, and Charles Pitts, we call him Skip, he played the thing on the wah-wah. I said, hey, play this line. And he started it. And I told Willie, the drummer, I said, Willie Hall, I said, give me that hi-hat, man, some 16 notes, you know. And he did that, and it worked. I said, that's the kind of dramatic effect I want. Then I started putting the other things in, you know, the bass, the accents and all that stuff. But that's how that whole wah-wah thing came about.
Well, why don't I play some of your theme from Shaft, a classic. This is Isaac Hayes.
Shut your mouth.
What I'm talking about, Sharon.
Yeah, we can do it.
He's
a complicated man, but no one understands him but his woman.
John Jack.
Time that Shaft and Superfly were really popular. I mean, everybody now, all the black filmmakers now, just credit those films with paving the way to all the new work that's happening now. But at the time, the NAACP was appalled at the black action films. And I wonder what your reaction was then to their reaction.
Well, you know, I had mixed emotions about that. That position was that, you know, it was painting a bad image.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the kids and so forth, and there were no alternatives. Had there been some alternatives at that time, then I don't think the NAACP would have come down so hard. But what happened was, when they did that, it was like it turned off the tap. It totally dried up for us because Hollywood said, whoops, hands off, and they dropped everything, and our whole little thing just died. I think, you know, in hindsight, had there been a little more patience at the time, maybe it could have taken off in some other directions, because that was in, it was in its embryonic stage at that time, you know, the black cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And anything in its infancy, you're going to get some, you're going to get a lot of crap. You're going to get some inferior things and all of that, and the quality and so forth, and even questionable subject matters. But as that particular genre grows, then, you know, you start getting better films and so forth. And I think they might have made the move a little bit too soon, because when we were doing these things, we weren't taking ourselves seriously, not as the characters. We were just glad to get the work, glad to get the experience, glad that our people could see us on screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and...
And as leading men.
Yeah, you know, and not with a broom and a mop and bowing and say, yes, sir, boss.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so that's why it took off, and it was so widely received. And I think had it had a little time to go, a little longer, you know, you've split off in some other areas, and Hollywood would have recognized that there is more that could sell than, you know, the pimps and the hookers and, you know, the private eyes and so forth.
I want to spend a couple of minutes talking with you about how you developed your image. When did you start shaving your head?
I started shaving my head not long after I got out of high school.
It wasn't fashionable then.
No, it wasn't.
To my knowledge. It was... So what inspired you to do it?
Well, you know, during those times as musicians, it was a fad. We had a relax in our hair. Called it a do, a conk process. And during that time, mine was cut very low and just slicked down on my head like all the way around like a coconut, you know. And it was hip. It was a style. But in the summertime, it was hard to keep up. And you sweat and it come undone and you had to sleep with a stocking cap on, all that kind of stuff. I said, I'm sick of fooling with this stuff. I'm going to cut it off. So I went to the barber shop around the corner from Stacks. I said, Mr. King, cut it all off. What? Cut it all off. I'm going to grow a new crop. And when he cut it off, you know, I went outside, you know, and I said, wow, it's a breeze out here. It feels great. I can feel the wind on my head. Hey, I think I'll keep it like this. I already had the beard. And people would look at me and say, oh, wow, oh, look at this guy, man. He's got bald in the beard. But I didn't care because it was different. I like being different. You know, I like swimming upstream. And a funny thing. One time, Booker T, by some error, had somebody book two dates on the same day for Booker T and MGs. And one date was in, I think Booker had to go to Oklahoma somewhere. And I went to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania with Al, Duck, and Steve. And David Porter was a vocalist. And I was to pretend to be Booker T. And I'm at the organ. We kicked off the tune, kicked off Green Onions, you know, and grooving. Somebody said, "Hey, man, that ain't no Booker T. He ain't got no hair." And, I mean, they were ready to riot. I jumped up from the organ and got out there with David, started dancing and singing and doing everything, trying to appease the people, you know. But finally, they said, "Well, okay, what the hell, we'll accept him." And, I mean, I played the entire gig. And, of course, years later, I went back as Isaac Hayes, and I played Harrisburg, and I told that incident, and some people remembered it, and they cracked up.
That's funny.
But, I mean, I was an unknown, but I just looked different. I liked a different look.
Are you still doing it?
Oh, yeah. You see, the thing about it is, it's ageless. So when I go naturally, no one will know.
Now, how did you start wearing gold and velvet and furs?
Well, you mean just day-to-day or...
Well, I don't know what you wore day-to-day, but I know you certainly wore that on stage.
Oh, now on stage, I wore... Okay, French rabbit boots. I wore tights of different colors. And I wore chains. Now, and I come out with a cape and a floppy hat. Why did I do that? Okay, a sense for the dramatics, okay? You see, at first I would wear... During the days of the hippies, I'd wear a lot of rawhide with fringes and beads and stuff and moccasins and bell-bottoms. And it was hot. It was hot. And later on, I thought, I said, when I see entertainers perform, they come out with three-piece suits on with ties. And the first thing they do is loosen the tie and throw the jacket off. And then they might take the vest off. I said, well, I'm going to go out there already comfortable. So what can I do? So I start wearing the vest and the tights. Tights are comfortable. Ballet dancers wear tights, so why can't I? And a guy gave me a chain necklace and a belt, and I tried that on stage. And when I came out like that, women were screaming. You know, I was always taking mental notes of effects and so forth. And I said, maybe I'll do this. And I started doing it, and somebody suggested, why don't you put a robe on because you want to go out there and give it to them all at one time. Put a robe, put a cape on, and then throw it off when you get out there. I tried that effect. Wow. And then I put a floppy hat on and showed my head later because I remember one time I went out on stage and I had a hat on, and it started sweating. I took it off to wipe my head, and women screamed. Okay, I'll use that too. And then this guy named Charles Rubin said, Isaac, said, I have an idea. I'm going to make you some chain vests. I said, okay, try that, and we'll see. And he made them, and it worked, and that's how that came. But I just like, I was a renegade. I had a renegade mentality. I always liked to be different.
Did you dress like that in private?
No. No, I mean, I dressed real fly. If you remember in Gorelnik's book, he described I had a purple suit on with some purple shoes and so whatever it was, standing outside of Stacks, remember? So I always dressed flamboyantly. I mean, you know, always flashy. I would dare to wear things that nobody else would try to wear. I had a girl to make me some Nehru suits and stuff like that back when nobody was wearing them. I saw the Pink Panther, and I liked the way Remember the first one where Capuchin, her chaperone, this guy was always around, tall, slim guy, had these Nehru collars and stuff on. I liked that look. So I had a girl to make a lot of those things for me.
So this must have been real different from when you were growing up, and you virtually had no clothes, you had no shoes. And
hey, you could put me out in the cornfield, I'd scare the crows away. you know, when you're like that, when you grow up in poverty, and you think about that meal you're going to have, you'd never be hungry again, Scarlett O'Hara. You think about the clothes you're going to wear. You think about the house you want to live in. You think about the cars. You know, so. When you start acquiring affluence, money. You buy these things and you enjoy it. And I worked all of my I didn't have a normal childhood, you know, like growing up, because I had to become the man in the family at an early age, so I didn't have a lot of chance to do the play things that kids do. So when you grow up and have the money, these things become toys and it becomes fun to you.
I thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, Terry, it's been my pleasure.
Isaac Hayes speaking with Terry Gross in 1994. Hayes died yesterday in East Memphis, Tennessee. He was 65.